All right, jaysanalysis.com. This time I have with me James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. James, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well today. How are you doing, Jay?
Doing great. We have some interesting topics we're going to discuss today. James has been around alternative media for about 8 years, he was telling me. I was mistaken. I was thinking it was even longer, 10 years. But you probably heard of James in alternative media circles. He's put out a tremendous amount of information that has, I think, really challenged a lot of the assumptions and presuppositions I had when I first came in contact with his work several years ago. So we want to get into a little bit about James first, and then we're going to talk about some of the recent articles and work that he's done. We're going to talk geopolitics, issues relating to technology and economics, big scale issues today on Jay's analysis. And I'd like to eventually maybe talk a little bit about China. We're limited with time, so we're going to go ahead and get into it. So, James, if you could, tell us about you and what got you started on this path.
Well, as you say, I've been in this now since 2007. That's when I started my website. And I'm a Canadian living in Japan. I was here just teaching English for a year, which turned into 2 years, which turned into 3 years. Now I'm on year number 11. So that's how that often goes. And I have a wife and child here now. And basically, it was in 2006 that I started to come across information on the internet that really changed my worldview completely, utterly. And it was, at first, it was information related to 9/11 and 9/11 truth. And then it was the financial manipulation, the central banking game that is played with the money supply. And once I started to learn about the history of the Federal Reserve and the central banks and how they manipulate money, that's really, I think, when the penny started to drop and I started to realize there was something very, very much more immense, more unimaginable, more crazy than I ever thought could have been possible. And so I was just so overwhelmed by the information I was encountering, I decided, well, I have to start spreading this to other people. My initial thought was I was going to start burning CDs of various podcasts and things I was listening to and hand them out to my friends here physically.
I did that.
And I would have done that if I was in Canada, but here I'm in Japan. I only have a limited number of English speakers that I can reach out to. But I thought, hey, well, it's the internet age. Might as well start an internet website. And so never in my life had I ever even contemplated starting a website or a podcast or anything of the sort. But literally within a couple of months of having that thought, I had a website up and going and a weekly podcast, and the rest is history.
Before we talk about Kakistocracy, I think the first thing that I saw from you that I really, really recall and really digging into was you did a whole special, a whole talk on PTEC and how that related to issues with 9/11. And this was probably, what, 2012, 2011, somewhere in there, when you did an extensive amount of research on that. And I think some guy had actually dropped a whole bunch of info because he had some connect to Unisys and PTEC. And so that led me to reading Michael Ruppert's book, Crossing the Rubicon, which has a good bit of information on this topic, too. So if you could, before we talk about a Kakistocracy, I want to get into PTEC and 9/11 because that's something that's kind of been pushed in the background and forgotten these days. Could you tell us about that? Because you did so much good work on that.
Well, this goes back to the early days of the Corbett Report. Back in 2008, I aired episode 45 of my podcast, which was called PTEC and the 9/11 Software. And the transcript of that is now up on my website. So I think it's just such an incredibly powerful story for people who don't know. Obviously, people who have heard about the concept of 9/11 truth, almost everyone associates that instantly and completely with the building collapses, the way they collapsed, the explosions, controlled demolitions, whatever it was. Well, look at that. That's very, you know, pyrotechnic and easy to sort of grasp. So that's what most people think 9/11 truth is. I've always had the sense that we have to take a broader perspective of what 9/11 is. And I think the PTEC story is one of those ways of getting into the story in a very different manner, but with some very, very powerful information. So this information comes from Indira Singh, who is a whistleblower who was the chief of risk management for JP Morgan Chase, obviously the largest financial institution in the world. So Chase didn't mess around with their risk management. They were looking for really cutting edge stuff. And at the just shortly before 9/11, they were looking into software that would help them to not only assess risks that were going on in the entire structure of their giant financial institution, but even to anticipate things that may come, insider trading or something, as they're happening, even before they happen, which sounds crazy, but that's what these types of high-level risk management software was looking into in the latter part of the last decade of the 20th century. So there's Indira Singh, and she gets a pitch from this company, PTEC, who has this software that is a type of risk management architecture software that could look at basically a god's eye view of an institution. It can take absolutely everything from systems to personnel to inventory, all of that, and graph and give you sort of an overview of how all of those things fit together so that you can adjust processes, or you can examine processes for things that are happening, etc. So she was getting this pitch from PTEC, but she was very uncomfortable with the way that they were presenting themselves and the types of things they were presenting. She did her due diligence and found that basically their contracts were with the absolute who's who of U.S. government agencies, the U.S. Armed Forces, Congress, Department of Energy, Department of Justice, FBI, Customs, FAA, IRS, Secret Service, White House, NATO itself. So this was a very high-level, high-functioning company with some incredible contracts that was providing this type of software that essentially gave whoever was running that software a giant key to the back door of whatever system this was placed on. And, you know, just take a look at some of those systems, the White House, the Secret Service, obviously some of the most sensitive systems in the country. She does some digging and finds that one of the sweetheart angel investors behind PTEC is someone who eventually, in the wake of 9/11, gets placed on the international terrorist watch list by the IRS as a the IRS, the Department of something. Well, anyway, he was placed on a terrorist watch list for his suspected ties to financing terror. And this is just a crazy story that the more you research into it, the crazier it gets. But suffice it to say, this company that had this backdoor software was working with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11, working specifically on interoperability between the FAA systems with NORAD and how they would function in the event of an emergency exactly like 9/11. And lo and behold, on 9/11, you have, of course, the blips that were being injected into the system as part of the drills that were going on that morning by NORAD, which were supposedly taken off the screen. But then you have flight controllers tracking a Phantom Flight 11 that was up in the air supposedly for 10 or 20 minutes after Flight 11 actually crashed into the towers. All these kinds of crazy things are happening in the computer systems, and here's this company with this financier, this terrorist financier, who's the sweetheart investor that has the back door and is working in the basement of the FAA, all of this craziness that's going on. And not only was it not really investigated, it was eventually in 2003, PTEC was raided as part of an operation to try to, you know, crack down on terrorist financing, and they were looking into the supposed connections here. But it was raided in, I believe, December of 2013, after they had been warned they were going to be raided, and the same day that the raid took place. I mean, they confiscate all these hard drives and all this information. The same day that they're raided, you have the person who was in charge of the raid, who I believe, I can't remember the FBI director at the time, but the FBI director or someone high up in the FBI came out and said, they're perfectly fine, nothing to see here. You know, it was all nothing. So they were immediately cleared. And it's one of those stories, the more you look into it, the crazier it gets. But it's, I think, one of those missing keys to the puzzle of what happened on 9/11.
I agree, and I'm glad that you highlighted that. And it makes me think of just a similar pattern that we've seen in this type of operation, where we think back to Iran-Contra with the BCCI, you know, with all these backdoor deals in terms of funding terrorist groups and laundering drug money and so forth. And yet, it, once again, it's the same thing, only, you know, a decade or so later with 9/11. And it also ties into a bunch of insurance fraud. There haven't been a lot of people that have covered the major level of insurance fraud that was going on in the background with 9/11. So that ties into the insider trading as well. And so I think that we're basically looking at the same, accurately titled it, a kakistocracy. I misspoke earlier, but that is essentially, well, I want you to get into it, but we saw in the news this week the fining of, what was it, $5.6 billion for JP Morgan Chase, Royal Bank of Scotland, these huge entities, the same types of people who would be at the Bilderberg Group meeting. These are the same. In other words, it's all sort of one angle on a singular one arm or appendage of a singular octopus, right? So, and it's the same cartel, I would say, for the most part, that's that we see involved in the rigging of these markets. And I think it's such a large scale operation, and that, you know, behind market rigging, you know, that that gives us a picture of the power of this kind of a mafia group. So could you go into some of that and your discussions of kakistocracy and what that is?
Well, I should give credit where credit is due. This term was brought to my attention by Professor Tjeerd Andringa of the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And I was out there in the Netherlands last year as a result of him basically putting a trip together for me to go talk about Gladio B and other things in the Netherlands. So he brought this idea to my attention, which is, for people who don't know, kakistocracy means rule by the worst or rule by the most evil, I guess. And it's just another model for sort of putting together an idea and an understanding of what that power structure actually looks like and how it functions, who's at the top. I think, again, we can all understand who have been in this for several years and have been looking at these different threads, that they do connect at the top, and there is some sort of oligarchy of some sort. There is a ruling group, a power structure, and there are people at the very top of that group. But how do we envision that? What is the ultimate structure of that group? And there's a lot of different ways that people try to imagine that. There are the people who say, well, it's all the Jews, it's all the Jesuits. If you ask the LaRoucheites, it's all the English. If you ask some of the some strains of the LaRoucheites, it's all the Viennese. It's all from Vienna. Not Vienna.
It's the black nobility.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I'm blanking. Anyway, but it, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at that. And of course, you have the idea of the corporatocracy. You have kleptocracy, the rule by thieves. You have psychopaths, pathocracy. So there's a lot of different ways to think about this. Kakistocracy is a different one. It's just basically the rule by the bad, the worst, the most evil people. And I think, again, as a model, it's really just that. It's just a model or a way of envisioning the world, but it can help us to understand certain things about this world. And I think, perhaps, in my estimation, perhaps less useful just as a term than something like pathocracy, which at least gives us an understanding of why the worst or the most evil come to positions of power in this system. Because ultimately, I think there clearly is a certain group of human beings who are capable of the type of evil that most people would not be capable of. And people may or may not have their own qualms about what that word evil means or how it's used. But I think we can all understand when you're talking about people who literally will not hesitate to kill 3,000 of their own citizens, let alone however many millions around the world, to forward their own political or economic fortunes. I think we can understand that as evil, the type of evil that most people wouldn't even contemplate. So how do those types of people get into positions of power? And I think we have to envision it as a structure where not only does the structure facilitate the sort of rise of people like that to positions of power, because obviously like flocks with like, but also I think it creates a system where it starts to turn people into a vision of itself. In order to rise to positions of power, if you have to be sort of a psychopath to get there, well, then people who aren't naturally born that way will start to act that way, will start to adopt those quirks, those mannerisms, that behavior. And that's not just a sort of theoretical thing. That's something that we have and can and has been studied and can be studied. Of course, there are things like the Stanford Prison Experiment from the 1970s, where they basically gave a bunch of students, they took a bunch of students, they divided them into two groups of jailers and jailed, and they put them in kind of a mock prison in the basement of Stanford for, I think it was supposed to be for a couple of weeks or something like that. They had to end the experiment after a few days because because the people who were acting as the jailers were starting to really get into some sadistic behavior with the people under their care and starting to...
Golding, Lord of the Flies.
Exactly right. And of course, we saw that's exactly how things played out at something like Abu Ghraib, where, of course, the people at the lower levels weren't the ones who were setting the policies or you know, ultimately... ultimately responsible for what happened in that sense, but of course they were responsible for their own actions, but placed in that environment, they just started to descend into the Lord of the Flies. So again, this is a documentable phenomenon, and I think we can see that on a societal scale, and there have been documentaries that talk about that, and how the corporatocracy is itself a type of pathocracy. So I think there's an overlap amongst these models, and I don't think any one is the fundamental explanation. I think it has to be an overlap of a bunch of different explanations. But kakistocracy is just one of those that we can use as a model to help understand the system, and hopefully by understanding it, find a way, not necessarily, I think, even to topple it, because I think that's the wrong paradigm. I think the real point is to get outside of that system, to start an alternative structure and to build that up, rather than to devote our life energy to fighting something that exists, because in that fight, you ultimately only end up propping up that structure.
Exactly, yeah. And we've seen so many revolutions be co-opted and engineered, you know, over several centuries, actually, I would say. So let's talk about how this might play out in terms of large-scale deceptions. I don't know your views on everything related to ISIS. I tend to take the perspective that most of the videos that were put forth were actually relatively cheesy stage productions. So I don't think that they're generally speaking legitimate or real productions. I think that it's propped up by a lot of intelligence work in this by the CIA and these different groups like Site Intelligence Network and things like that, and Rita Katz's group. So could you give your analysis of what's going on with ISIS and all these videos, and is it a psyop? Do you think it's really, you know, are they really becoming a caliphate or what?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there's clearly manipulation on so many of these videos. Obviously, the Japanese one that I'm familiar with here that got a lot of play here to scar the Japanese psyche at a convenient time for the Prime Minister of Japan was clearly manipulated. You can see the shadows falling in different directions as if there were two suns or as if there were two studio lights, and this was done in front of a green screen. So I think there's a lot of that going on. Clearly, there's some manipulated videos, but of course, you could find a way to put that in the official story by saying, well, of course, ISIS isn't filming this outside in the desert. They're filming it at a studio somewhere and trying to make it look like that. So you could, I don't know, you could come up with some
sort of narrative. I've heard that rebuttal, but I don't buy it. But
yeah, nor do I. But at any rate, it's undecidable from our viewpoint with the limited information that we have. But I think we have to put that in the fuller context of what ISIS is and where it came from. And for people looking for that fuller context, I did a report late last year about ISIS, who is really behind ISIS, where we talk about the incredible history of ISIS, because this isn't a group that just suddenly sprang out of nowhere last summer to start taking over parts of Iraq. This is a group that has forerunners, is kind of related to organizations that have been around since 1999, right, and were founded by a Jordanian militant who ended up in Iraq eventually, and it eventually became Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And there's all these leaders of this group that have these remarkable careers of having been killed multiple times. They're reported as dead, and then they're back again suddenly without being reported as, you know, the without the last report being retracted. And that happens multiple times, or they're captured and released, and all of this craziness. So all of that history, I think, is important to this. But ultimately, what's going on here, I think we have to understand, as was recently confirmed by documents that have just been released as part of the emails and brouhaha around Clinton and all of that, is that there's no doubt that ISIS is exactly what the U.S. and its allies, the Gulf states and Israel and everyone else in that region who has an interest in seeing the overthrow of Assad, that's exactly what they want. That's exactly what they wanted since the beginning. They wanted the rise of these, you know, Sunni militants to basically overthrow Assad and to be a counterbalance against the Shia Iranians in the region, who would otherwise, all things being equal, be the dominant player in the region. So they need a counterbalance. This is exactly the group they want to happen, and the exact kind of group that they knew would come together if they continued to fund the so-called peaceful opposition to Assad in Syria. So this is, again, I think we have to look at it from that perspective. And then when you really start to dig into it and you see that, for example, Benghazi was all about the gun running that was going on through Benghazi from Libya to Syria to help fund the Syrian, or to arm the Syrian rebels, as they like to be called, the terrorists. Yes, exactly. Al-Nusra, the Al-Nusra Front, ISIS, it all becomes one in part and parcel. So do I think that every single member of ISIS is a fictional character who's been created? No. I mean, of course, there are real people here who really do probably truly believe that they're fighting to create a caliphate. But of course, at the very top, who are they funded by? Who are they controlled by? How did the CIA, for example, not see this developing with their run against Iraq last summer and the incredible thing, the convoy and everything? How was that not bombed out of existence? It's because it was allowed to happen. So we have to see it in that context. And when we do, we realize that exactly as it has been for the past century, militant Islam is just once again being used as a convenient tool for the Pentagon and its allies as basically a weapon that it can be used against the enemies of those states.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And it's, as I've pointed out many times on my articles, is really just the extension of the older British imperial plan, you know, the old British spy plan of co-opting and basically disintegrating and creating microstates in the Middle East, you know, the 100-year-old British plan with the British agents, Harry St. John Philby and people like that. I'm not saying that it's the LaRouche thesis that it's all British, but I'm saying that with Brzezinski and people like that in the 70s and so forth, you have the adoption of that model of, you know, where the American empire, the American foreign policy needs to take things. They're sort of the engine of this global world order that we're supposed to accept under the guise of democracy, under the guise of NGOs and bringing freedom and, you know, what's supposed to be free markets to these different places.
Right. And I think in a sense, you can see this as just a continuation of the First World War. I mean, I really think there's a historical continuity from that time and the redrawing of the map in the wake of that war to what's going on right now in the Middle East and elsewhere. I think that, in a sense, the world has been at war. It's just that the world has been the target of that war, and it's the Kakistocracy or whatever, that element at the very top that's been waging that war against the people, and this is just another element of that.
The new freedom of Woodrow Wilson, right? Huh. So let's talk about how that ties into, in a way, I think, the situation with this rash of bankster suicides that we've seen. I wrote an article last year about how I saw a neat parallel, possibly, between Tom Tykwer's 2009 film, The International, which is about this cadre of bankers that are tied into all sorts of corruption, as well as international arms trade. And by one, they're offed. They just start dying, you know, dropping like flies. I'm not saying that I know for sure that Tykwer's film had anything directly related to it. I just saw it as an interesting parallel. So what is, you did a nice piece on this. What is your thesis on, tell us about this, your thesis on the market rigging and the suicides, or supposed suicides, and maybe more?
Well, I should stress, I don't think I have a thesis on it per se. I'm not going to say what I think this is or isn't, but I think there are some intriguing possibilities that deserve to be looked into. And I think one of the factors at play here is pattern recognition. It's just one of those things where you start to notice something and then suddenly it's everywhere. Like when there's a bird die-off or something and that gets reported, suddenly everyone's reporting on all these bird die-offs and it feels like a new phenomenon. Oh, wait, no, it's been going on for a while. It's just people weren't reporting on it. So I think to a certain extent we can look at that this phenomenon in those terms. But there are some interesting, really real patterns that I think start to emerge from this. And one of the interesting ones that I found when I was doing some research on this was the fact that a lot of the young people who are committing suicide or ending up in strange deaths here are people who have worked in some capacity as tech interns or tech specialists for J.P. Morgan. And there's several of them. I highlight a few of them in my recent article on the bankster suicides, Andrew Jarzik and Gabriel McGee and Kenneth Belindo. And there's a lot of others, all under 40, all dying in mysterious circumstances or by suicide. And all of them having worked in some capacity with JP Morgan in IT of some sort, which I think is interesting because that potentially, if this is an international scenario, I haven't seen that movie, but I understand the concept. If it is that kind of scenario, then that would point to, well, what's going on in terms of the, you know, the IT department of JP Morgan that they don't want coming out? And there's a lot of intriguing possibilities there. I mean, let's keep in mind, JP Morgan was looking at P-TECH a couple of decades ago. So that's one fascinating thing that comes out of this.
Absolutely. How many stories have we seen, too, about the rigging, again, of markets and flash trades? And so the people who would...
Exactly, you know, right. But don't worry, the DOJ just got their man in London, supposedly. Some guy who lives with his mother, who apparently was the solely responsible for the flash crash of 2011 and, you know, did this from his home.
Yeah, right. No, I'm not trying to say that... Like, we got him,
yeah. No. No, I know what you're saying, but I'm just saying the official line on that is absolutely ridiculous. No, of course, there is obvious rigging that's... to a certain extent, you can't even say the markets are manipulated these days because the markets are manipulation these days. There is no market at this point. Yes. Right. So anyway, but yes, so there's some intriguing possibilities there. And let's not forget, as I think you just mentioned, there was just some huge multi-billion-dollar fines to a lot of these companies, including JP Morgan, that were just caught up in the there's a few different manipulation scandals that are going on right now. So there's LIBOR, there's the foreign exchange trading manipulation that was just there was just some big fines handed down. So people with inside information about that, of course, possibility. Another intriguing possibility in all of this, one that sounds perhaps even more outlandish, but is really fascinating and deserves more looking into, is the dead peasants insurance, which people might have heard about in the past decade and a half. This has been talked about. I only think I ever heard about it in terms of Walmart and companies like that, big retailers that take out life insurance on their employees without even necessarily their employees knowing about it. And in the event of the employee's death, the company makes the money from those insurance policies. Something that kind of, in a way, I guess you could say it makes sense for a company that has an important executive or something. If he were to die, then, you know, that would affect the company itself, like a Steve Jobs or whatever. I guess it makes sense in that sense. But of course, once that's allowed into law, the companies just start buying it up wholesale on all their workers and then basically waiting for them to die. Or waiting for them to die. And there was an interesting report written in 2011 about this phenomenon by Ellen Schultz called Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from Nest Eggs of American Workers. And she noted that there was a report that was done by an insurance agent to Mutual Benefit Life Insurance Company looking at this dead peasants insurance phenomenon and noting that there was one company that this agent looked at called NCC, no details given, which had a very good death rate. They predicted a certain amount of death rate, so they took out insurance policies based on that, and they were very close to meeting their target, unlike a lot of other companies who were disappointed that not enough people were dying. But NCC had enough people dying. People were dying at 78% expected mortality. And as the agent notes, however, this includes 3 suicides within the first year, which is highly unusual. Without these suicides, NCC would be running at 33% expected mortality. This fact highly concerns me. And again, that's from a note from an insurance agent to Mutual Benefit Life Insurance Company that came out as part of a court proceeding. So internal documents that show that there are people who are concerned about the possibility that suicides, well, somebody's making money off of these deaths, and there's a direct financial interest in it. So I'm not necessarily saying that is an explanation, but it could potentially be, and it absolutely should be more talked about, more publicized, more known that banks are taking out life insurance policies on their workers that could be affecting this strange rash of suicides we see going on.
I had heard that. I don't know if it was the exact dead peasant situation, but I had heard that about Walmart doing that. Specifically with their workers, and that maybe that this insurance money was then being they were using it to speculate, right? So putting it into derivatives and things like that. And so when you look back at, like I said, with 9/11, the insurance fraud that was going on there, I think that was in the Washington Post or maybe even Forbes had some piece about something to do with insurance fraud at the time of 9/11. So I don't just mean insurance in terms of Larry Silverstein having insurance for the complex. I'm talking about insurance companies being involved in, insurance money being funneled, you know, into all these black market accounts and using that to actually speculate with derivatives and things like that. So it all gets jumbled into this big, huge, you know, tangled mess. But it does all tie together because it basically there's just a shadow finance system that's behind a lot of this, and it ties directly into the tech stuff that you were talking about, the PTEC and all that, the back doors. And that would lead me into the next question. Where are we going with all of this crazy tech stuff? So I write a lot, quite a bit about AI and things like that. I don't believe that AI is sentient or anything ridiculous like that, or that they're going to take over in the sense of becoming alive. I think that's pretty ridiculous. But we do have to worry about the threat of, I think, humans programming smart cities with AI grids that will use, you know, pre-crime, as the IBM CEO Jenny Romney speaks about in her lectures. So I'd like to get your thought on the dangers of that, given the fact that you did a piece on highlighting DNA shaming and how this was sort of a test run where they were picking people's wrappers up and, you know, figuring out a basic conception of who this person was by daring to throw a gum wrapper down.
Yeah, I think part of our problem when confronting this growing threat, I mean, genuine threat of the Orwellian tech nightmare control grid that we're stumbling into quite blindly, is that we are often victims of our own lack of imagination to really understand how this is going to play out, which is why we so often turn to sort of science fiction as our template for, you know, what could happen in the future, because obviously writers have a good imagination and can actually not just randomly pick things out of a hat, but actually extrapolate from current trends to see what this type of technology could look like in the future. But hey, the future is now. And so I got a tip in a couple of weeks ago from a listener that I thought was creepy. I mean, I'm immersed in this all the time, and even this even managed to creep me out. It basically, in Hong Kong, there's a group, an NGO called Hong Kong Cleanup, that's you know, it's a nice harmless little organization that's just basically advocating that once a year people go out on the streets and pick up trash and, you know, make the place look cleaner. What could be wrong with that? Well, they did this bizarre marketing campaign, I guess, for their NGO, which interestingly enough is funded by by the Nature Conservancy, which has on its board members of the Blackstone Group and Google, right, and Goldman Sachs and Merck and all these people. So make of that what you will. But anyway, this, as part of their marketing campaign, they contracted Ogilvy and Mather to come up with an idea. And the idea they struck on is, okay, let's take some of these pieces of garbage that we see scattered around, cigarette butts or condoms or whatever, take them, analyze the DNA on them, construct a facial representation. So make from that DNA, what would that face look like? And then put posters of those faces up in the area that the garbage was found, with a picture of the garbage itself, kind of mock wanted posters, wanted for littering. And they actually did that. And you can watch the video of how they did that and everything. And I mean, there's obviously so many problems with this. For example, how about DNA contamination? Do we really suspect that the only possible traces of DNA on this litter is the DNA of the litterer? I mean, it's out there in the elements. It could be exposed to literally anything. But anyway, I mean, all of that aside, just the idea of this should be creepy enough. Not just in the sense that, you know, this is some sort of wacky advertising campaign, but think about this technology in the hands of a government that has gone tyrannical, and how they can use that against their own citizens to basically, you know, become this DNA control grid society where anything you even touch can be associated with you and then used to convict you at least in the court of public opinion by, you know, putting up DNA pictures or wanted pictures or whatever. And of course, that even leaves out the question of to the extent to which all of this is quackery. And I think there is a large degree of that because, in fact, just recently we had a study coming out revealing fundamental flaws in gene testing that has led to all sorts of crazy results, wrong results, that obviously affect people in the justice system, where right, obviously gene testing and DNA testing is a common practice. So there's all of those types of problems with this. But again, the point is, in a tyrannical society with a tyrannical government that wants to target a certain individual, all they would have to do is come out and say, yes, we found your DNA on this, and use that to convict you. So it's, again, I think we have to understand just how this is not some kind of crazy sci-fi fantasy. This is really happening right now. And again, we have to be aware of the fact that we're stumbling into this future quite blindly and quite blissfully unaware.
Right. Do you think that there's a danger also with smart cities being run by an AI grid? I certainly think there is.
Oh, of course. I mean, again, AI makes it sound all kind of, well, you know, it's just running according to its algorithms, so there's nothing taking place. But of course, I mean, anything is going to be programmed by someone and for a purpose. And obviously the smart city idea is the idea of total, complete control. I mean, utter control over everything. And we're getting to the point where literally, I mean, I in California a few years ago, they had something put on the books where basically the California government reserves the right to come in and adjust your thermostat if they feel that you're using too much energy. And, you know, during a heat wave, if you're running your AC too long, well, the government reserves the right to come in and change that. And now the technology for doing that is here. They can actually literally reach into your house through the smart grid and operate, you know, what electronics you're using. So again, I think a lot of people don't even understand that the technological capabilities for this is already in place. And in some cases, the legislation for it is already being put in place.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's all part of the large trade deals that are all tied into the idea of smart cities and Agenda 21 and all this sustainability, which we've seen pushed so hard in propaganda for the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years even. I remember back in the 80s, you know, I saw ads for, you know, how bad humanity was, the population growth was, that this was killing the earth. And back then it was global warming and so forth. But let's talk about China and the New World Order, because I think you have been one of the few in alternative media that has had a level head about this, because we tend to see this picture put forth by a lot of alternative media outlets that China is, you know, somehow fighting the Atlanticist establishment. And while I recognize that there may be nationalist elements in China that would like to, you know, preserve their traditions and their culture, my perspective on China, as I understand it, is that they're very much in bed with the Western establishment. In fact, if you read David Rockefeller's memoirs, you know, he's been pretty much behind what's going on in China for a long time, at least very much intimately connected with it. And we have, Bill Donovan is who set up the spy apparatus for Mao throughout China. So I think the point of debate becomes a situation of, well, is there significant enough self-consciousness on the part of China to really truly be in opposition to the West? And I would say that if we look at the Fortune 100 and their relationship to China, I don't see it as very much of a legitimate opposition.
I don't see it that way either. And it does surprise me just how quickly and how wholeheartedly a lot of the alternative media has taken on this narrative that China and the BRICS are going to be some sort of fundamental block to this New World Order system and not just a part of it. And I don't know whether necessarily, you know, everyone involved in this is a willing and conscious participant, but the sort of opposition that these groups are offering by its very nature will lead to nothing other than the furthering of the very New World Order system that they're supposedly designed to counteract. And so I did talk about that at great length in my China and the New World Order podcast episode that I think is it's important because it has a lot of leads to a lot of stories that connect some of these dots. But here's just a recent example of a story that I thought was interesting. It was brought to my attention by a commenter on my website that recently William Engdahl, whose work I highly respect, he's written some excellent books, but he recently had a post up on the New Eastern Outlook, Russia gets very serious on de-dollarizing, where he says Russia is about to take another major step towards liberating the ruble from the dollar system, and starts to talk about how they're going to start issuing Russian bonds denominated in Chinese yuan. That's amazing, you know, if this takes place. And as I noted when this was brought to my attention, well, you know, the UK was actually the first place to issue, the first non-Chinese state to issue renminbi bonds. And they started doing that last year. So I didn't see anyone in the alternative media saying, wow, you know, the UK is taking a drastic step towards liberating themselves from the dollar system.
That's a good point.
You know, it's a sort of selective eye that a lot of people have to these types of stories. And I think the ultimate point that we have to take away from this is that the ultimate goal of this system is not for the U.S. dollar to maintain its hegemon over the world and the U.S. military to maintain its hegemon over the world. The new world order system is about world government, about the world, the global order, the global monetary paradigm that's coming into view. And that cannot take place without incorporating, you know, 1/6 of the world's population, i.e. China. And that is being brought into the world the international economic fold right now in this process that we've seen specifically over the past decade and a half of the great rise of the Chinese economy. And we're seeing that start to come to fruition now with China's seemingly inevitable inclusion in the SDR basket, the special drawing rights basket of the IMF, which I really think is, if not itself, at least that model is going to be the model for the next world reserve currency. And of course, there are people in the United States, you know, government and within the U.S. oligarchy, as it were, that are against that and want to maintain the U.S. hegemon. But I think the overarching agenda and the people at the very top, they don't care about the United States any more than the Chinese oligarchs care about the Chinese, etc. I think at the very top, they are more interested in protecting their own interests, and their interests transcend any of these nation state ideas that have been foisted on the public and which blinker us from what's really going on. So, yes, there's a lot to talk about with regards to China and its collusion with the Western finance oligarchs at the very top levels. Again, I'm sure there are people in the Chinese government who really do believe in their nationalism, but at the very top, it's all connected. And these types of stories about, you know, issuing bonds in renminbi and things like this are just more examples of how ultimately we are being steered in the direction of the rise of the yuan. And it's not just, you know, Russia and China that are doing it. It's the West is actively taking its role in this as well.
Yeah, there might be a divergence of opinion amongst neoconservative types who have an American imperialist perspective of how things need to go because of, you know, money tied up in defense contracting and things like that are affected more directly by the dollar. But you have the technocratic perspective that's more of the, you know, ready to jump into directly into globalism now for, you know, pro UN, you know, Fabian style stuff. That's a little more progressive, quote unquote, in their mind than the neoconservative Straussian type approach. But I'm looking right now at Goldman Sachs' archives in November 2001. Their analyst Jim O'Neill is who actually coined the term BRICS and how important BRICS was going to be for the future. So Goldman Sachs is tied directly into this. Jim O'Neill was the managing director of investments for Goldman Sachs. Yes. So this is
BRIC, you know, is literally an idea that, as you say, was created by Jim O'Neill in 2001 and then became a political reality. The BRIC nations looked at that and said, hey, well, that sounds like a good idea. And then they threw in South Africa because they needed something on the African continent to kind of look like a global entity. And that's all it is. I mean, it's just a pretty much random grouping of five different economies that really don't have a lot to do with each other and don't have a lot in common and have competing interests, but were literally created as part of a Goldman Sachs research paper, and they decided to make that a political reality. So there's the opposition, folks. That's what's going to save the world.
Yeah, I'm glad to see you point that out. I got some flack for pointing that out to people. But before we let you go, I know that we're closing in on 45 minutes here. Give us a couple books that I don't hear people doing this anymore. I'm a big bibliophile. I like books. I know we're in the internet age where we just read internet articles, but you're a very well-read guy, very educated. What are some books that you would recommend to readers that have influenced you that you think are worth checking out?
Well, I would always recommend books of some of the people I work with and some of the sort of people I've interviewed over the years. The Lone Gladio by Sibel Edmonds is absolutely amazing book, a fiction, quote unquote, book, but really talking about Gladio B, which people may or may not be familiar with. If you're not, please do look up Gladio B and Sibel Edmonds' incredible work exposing what that's all about. Or, of course, there's also her nonfiction book, Classified Woman, which is about her story blowing the whistle on the FBI in the wake of 9/11. There's James Perloff's excellent one-volume history, what you really need to know about the CFR, called The Shadows of Power. Absolute must-read. There's William Engdahl, Seeds of Destruction, absolutely brilliant book that I always constantly go back to, as it really does lay out the sort of Monsanto monopolization of the food supply that's going on, and the Rockefeller aegis behind that. I'm also reading his Myths, Lies, and Oil War right now, which is a 2013 book. I'm ashamed to say I'm only reading it right now, but I'm not done, so I guess I can't vouch for it. But from what I've read, it's, again, very powerful, very well-researched material. I'm also, on the World War One note, I'm reading Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War, which lays out the British culpability, the Rhodes Roundtable / Rothschild collusion in starting the First World War, which I think is a fascinating and much neglected piece of that history.
And who's that?
That is by a couple of researchers from England, Jerry Doherty and Jim McGregor. So definitely check that out. I think it's worth reading. The Creature from Jekyll Island, if you're interested in the Federal Reserve, of course. I always recommend that people take a look at the other side of the issue as well. I mean, there's some kind of mainstreamy type of history books that I think are worth reading as well. I mean, Triple Cross by Peter Lance, talking about Ali Mohammed, the triple agent who was he FBI, CIA, or Al-Qaeda? Yes, yes, and yes. The crazy, crazy, crazy story. Even the official kind of mainstreamy version of that is crazy and worth looking into. Or read the 9/11 Commission Report. If you've never read it, actually read it. Actually find out what they want you to believe is the official story. It's good to know.
What I find funny about the 9/11 Report is how childish it's written. Mm-hmm. It's and I guess, you know, a lot of it is from news sources and things like that, so that might be part of it, but it's so dumbed down. And
it's just very much written as a narrative, which is interesting. It almost reads not like a novel, but it is more like a story than it is a report. And it's interesting from that perspective because it's clearly for propagandistic purposes. It's easier to read than you would expect, and I think there's a reason behind that.
All right, before we let you go, what's upcoming from the Corbett Report?
Oh, there's always a million things that I'm working on. I won't let too much out of the bag, but yes, the next big project that I'm thinking about does relate to what we were talking about earlier about World War One and its continuation over the past century as really an ongoing war against the public. So that's kind of the bigger thing that I'm thinking about. Other than that, I'm always working on a million different things. I just recorded New World Next Week with James Evan Pilato, of course, my weekly series, and he says to say hi to you, because I believe you talked to him a couple months ago.
Yeah, he's a really great guy.
He really is. What else? Oh, I'm about to release a podcast about truth comedy, which I think is an interesting topic and one that doesn't get a lot of attention.
Well, I have some good impersonations of Alex Jones, so yeah, if you want me to come on and do impersonations, I'm always available. But thank you, James Corbett, CorbettReport.com, and we'll let you go, and maybe we can talk again in the future sometime.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
All right, thanks.